This story will prepare us for the next section, because you remember the first half of Daniel is six stories, and the second half is four visions, and the last story is about a literal lion, and the first vision is of a metaphorical, you know, or a symbolic lion. So it's preparing us for the second half of the book. And again, just quickly, Daniel's character comes into view. He has an excellent spirit. He's called the servant of the living God by the king. He says that God shut the lion's mouth because I was found blameless before him and also before you. He means the king. And remember that now, at this point, Daniel had been in government service for probably somewhere near 60 years. And imagine that. There's no mark against him after 60 years of service in the government. Tremendous character this man had. And then his faith, he says that God shut the lion's mouth because he trusted in his God. And Hebrews 11, who through faith shut the mouth of lions. And so Daniel wasn't just passive. And then his courage comes to the fore in verse 10. You want to look there. Daniel 6 and verse 10. You remember they passed the edict that you can't pray to anybody except the king for 30 days, which is a very foolish edict. And it says, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. You remember that was very symbolic when they dedicated the temple. Solomon prayed that, Lord, if anybody, wherever they are in the world, will turn their face towards the temple or even the ruins of the temple, you know, would you hear from heaven? So they'd have the temple even if they were distant geographically from it. So he has his windows open towards Jerusalem, and he got down upon his knees, and usually a Jewish person would pray standing up, but he gets down on his knees, and three times a day, and he prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. And so he won't let his rhythm, and remember this is the second in the kingdom, you imagine all his administrative responsibilities, and this empire extends from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, of which Judah was just one. And his enormous administrative responsibility, about three times a day, he stops to pray. Astonishing man. Verse 11, then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And you would think, well, Daniel, you know, can't you just pray in your heart, you know, for 30 days and, you know, 30 nights? But there's sometimes where we need to draw a line in the sand, you know, and just say, you know, this is where we're going to make a stand, and this is what he does. And his prayer life, actually, is mentioned three times in the book of Ezekiel. Daniel was a great prayer. And his deliverance was angelic. He says God sent his angel, shut the lion's mouth. And his loyalty, I say, by putting loyalty to God above loyalty to the states, he had been more truly loyal to the states than those who gave it a kind of quasi-divine status. And sometimes the greatest loyalty we can have to the states is actually to be disobedient. Because, you know, the state has certain parameters around it given by God, and if they violate those parameters, as they did in the book of Acts, they politely said, you know, we must obey God rather than man, when they said you can't proclaim the gospel. And sometimes we are the most loyal to the state when we refuse in certain situations to go along with it. And I remember, I always think of this point of Ardian, who many of you know, his infusion is from Albania. And his father was a very educated man, educated in the Sorbonne in Paris. And for his opposition to the communist regime, they were exiled to the border of Albania, a tiny village where his father could get no work at all. He was overqualified to do everything. And but that kind of, that is loyalty. Do you see what I mean? That is real patriotism. When your government makes a major wrong turn, you know, and you say, we cannot go with this. And I had a good friend, just to show you the extent to which it went, I had a good friend who went into Albania and lived there before the communist regime collapsed. And he was on the street one day, and an old man tapped him on the shoulder and kind of, you know, beckoned to him and brought him into his little house and shut the door, pulled down the shutters, posted a guard, opened a little cabinet, and pulled out, you remember those record players where you turn the handle? And put on a record, and it was Silent Night, Holy Night. So afraid, and he said, we do this once a year. So, and they had to play Silent Night with a guard outside the door. That's how bad it got, you know. But true patriotism, as seen in Daniel, is to say enough is enough. Just to conclude here, the character and actions of King Darius. Probably the reason they had lions is hunting continued to be a royal pastime in the Persian period. But his love and respect for Daniel, it says in verse 14 that he was distressed and he labored till the sun went down to try and deliver him. It's rather beautiful, isn't it? And then he prays for him despite his restriction on prayer, which I rather like. He says, may your God whom you serve continually deliver you. Well, the king shouldn't have been talking to God, but he broke his own edict and spent the night fasting. But unfortunately, it's his vanity and short-sightedness that he should sign such an edict, because prayer is what brings prosperity into society. When we start banning prayers, as we do in our schools, it is utter stupidity, and that's what the king... But the ending of the story is phenomenal. If you go to 25 and 26, now Nebuchadnezzar, you remember, was the ruler who had made a proclamation when he made the image that all peoples, plural, that would be ethnic groups, peoples, languages, and nation should bow down, you remember, to his image that he set up, that all peoples, nations, and languages should bow down. And now he makes another proclamation, verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, which would have been the known earth, his empire, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Before he'd made a proclamation that all peoples, nations, and languages should bow down to the image. Now he makes one that reverses it and says you should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. And he delivers and rescues. And so just with one man drawing a line and saying enough is enough, a proclamation, you know, this is how God evangelizes the earth, okay? Just one man making a stand, and through that one man, a proclamation is made about his God from India to Ethiopia. You know, that's what God can do. And you remember, as I said last week, we drew our little map of Palestine, you remember, and we said the first time when Israel went out of the land was down to Egypt, and God sent somebody ahead of them whose name was Joseph, who is an unknown, a nobody, who's in the prison. But the king gets a dream, and because he can interpret that dream, he becomes the second in the kingdom and prepares the way for Israel to come down. Now they're going to go out again to Babylon, and before they go, about 15 years before they go, God sends a young man. His name is Daniel. Okay, he's a nothing and a nobody. Okay, among, you know, the whole group of that early group of exiles. Okay, the nation are not yet gone. The king has a dream, chapter 2. Daniel can interpret it, And through that, he becomes number two in the realm and prepares the way for his people coming again. So we get exactly the same pattern repeated. Okay, first time out, Joseph. Second time out, Daniel. One last thing, which I find particularly beautiful, is the parallel between Daniel in the lion's den and Jesus on the cross. And you might like to grab hold of that piece of paper. I'm just going to read through this and point out some of what it means. But this for me is one of the great fascinations of the scripture. You know, how that God can so orchestrate things. You see, it's one thing for God, you know, to make a prophecy, you know, a virgin shall conceive, you know, because he can do that, you know, through his power, you know, or he'll be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. But what always amazes me is how that one person can prefigure another person. Just astounding. You see that in David, you see that in Joseph, etc. But here, I'll just read through because it really is beautiful. Okay, he, Jesus, is the victim of conspiracy and betrayal from people whose position is threatened by him, just like Daniel. And for Jesus, it was the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests who seek occasion to manipulate higher authorities. With Daniel, it's Darius. With Jesus, it's Herod, Pilate, etc., into executing him, professing that they have no king but Caesar, or in the case of Daniel, no god but Darius. Of course, Caesar was the same, you know, quasi-divine figure. And number two, they too will eventually pay for their hostility along with their children. And you remember the enemies of Daniel are cast into the lion's den, just as Jesus weeps over Jerusalem, not for himself, but he says, "Woe to you, women of Jerusalem, because you've refused your time of visitation, and there's going to be destruction of the city." The same parallel. Number three, he too, Jesus, is arrested, just like Daniel, in the place of prayer. If you're going to get arrested in the place of prayer. That's the place to get arrested. Jesus in Gethsemane, and Daniel with his windows open towards Jerusalem. Number four, these higher authorities, too, find no fault in him. You remember Pilate says about Jesus, "I find no guilt in this man." And the king, well, the enemies of Daniel can find no fault in him, even though he's been in government service for 60 years. And labor to free him, so Darius labors all day to free Daniel, but can't. Pilate tries three times to get Jesus released, but can't, but are reminded that the law forbids it. In this case, the law of the Medes and the Persians, which can't be revoked. In the case of Jesus, you remember they say, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. They threaten him. They threaten them with the law. Verse 5, he too has to rely on God to deliver him as his tomb is sealed. And look in verse 17. What an astonishing picture. This is Daniel 6:17. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den. It's almost the Gospels, isn't it? The mouth of the tomb. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring, just as they sealed the tomb of Jesus, never expecting to see him alive again. But then verse 6, or point 6, then very early at sunrise, he too, Daniel, is discovered, just like Jesus, to be alive after all. And these parallels you find again and again in the scriptures. You know, what a evidence of supernatural inspiration. It's astonishing. Daniel chapter 7 is without doubt one of the most important chapters in the Old Testament. Does anybody know why offhand? It is for two reasons. One is because here the Son of Man appears. The first time we get this this human and yet this kind of superhuman figure. And Jesus, when he announces himself in his favorite phrase as the Son of Man, okay, he is defining himself by Daniel chapter 7. We used to talk about, well, Jesus called himself the Son of Man because he wanted to show he was one of us. Well, there's a truth in that, but no, he was being very deliberate in saying, I am the figure you see in Daniel chapter 7. So that makes it, without doubt, of great importance. The second reason is because the rise of the Antichrist is described in Daniel chapter 7, and we'll see that, which is of secondary importance, I believe, to the first, but it is without doubt very important. So, Daniel 7, and let me just show you. I've mentioned the six stories, first six chapters, four visions, last six chapters. Now, what is fascinating is you remember that the first half of Daniel, well, nearly the first half, is in Aramaic. Begins after the introduction in chapter 1, 2, 4, to the end of 7 is Aramaic. And then chapter 8 through to 12 is Hebrew. Now what we seem to have happening here is very, very interesting. Because, you see, Daniel 7 then sits in both halves of the book. Are you with me? Because it's the first vision, okay, here it is, the first vision, sitting right up here. It's the first vision, but it's after, okay, it's the Aramaic flows right through it. And so it's the end of the Aramaic, and it's the beginning of the visions. So it's almost as if intentionally we're supposed to see this as the centerpiece of the book. And indeed it is. So let's have a bit of a read. We'll get into it slowly, because this is interesting and difficult material. And let me just say that there are more than one way of interpreting Daniel chapter 7. And so, you know, if what you've been taught is a little different, don't worry. And I'll give you a bibliography at the end of Daniel, and you can track down some of my sources and other scholars who take a different view. But I actually think that wherever you land, the message of Daniel 7 doesn't change. Okay? The basic fundamental message doesn't change. So don't get too worried if you think that, you know, I'm pursuing kind of a exegetical path that you're not so familiar with. It will not detract from, in fact, I believe it will increase the basic message of Daniel. So chapter 7 and verse 2. Let's get into this. And could I say, this material is very important, very complex, and if you don't understand anything, please don't be afraid to ask, okay? Because it is difficult, but it's very, very intriguing and interesting. Chapter 7, verse 2. Daniel said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, which is usually a metaphor for the nations. The nations were being stirred up, and four great beasts came out of the sea, out of the nation, different from one another. Remember, this is apocalyptic material, all symbolic, metaphorical, etc. Verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And we learn that this is Nebuchadnezzar, this is Babylon. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off. You remember, Nebuchadnezzar, God brings him down. From a great height, it's like a bird. His wings come off and he falls to the earth, you remember? And he is like an animal for 7 years. Okay, it does fall down, and it was lifted up eventually from the ground and made to stand upon 2 feet like a man again. He was a beast, and the mind of a man was given to it. He was restored, you remember, in his right mind. Verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear, comes. Now I'll identify this as Media, and it was raised up on one side, or you could translate it, raised up on one ruler. And it had three ribs in its mouth, possibly from devouring the last rulers of Babylon, three ribs in its mouth, and between its teeth, And it was told, arise and devour much flesh. And media arises, and after media arises, after under Darius, Persia arises. And Darius then gets called Cyrus. But Persia was the greater. And so this beast, okay, one side is going to be more powerful eventually than the other. And then verse 6, after this I looked, and lo, another like a leopard with four wings. Notice we've had four winds and four beasts, and now we've got four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, another four, and dominion was given to it. And I think this is the great empire of Persia, which was indeed a mighty empire. Verse 7, and after this I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, terrible and dreadful and exceedingly strong, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And this I'm going to identify, and I'll give you my reasons. They're not really mine, but the scholars' reasons why we think that this is probably the Greek Empire rather than the Roman. The more traditional is that it's Rome, and I think it's better seen as the Greek. And out of, you remember, Alexander comes in like a whirlwind, and when he comes into the region, the interesting thing about Alexander is he takes everything. He takes Egypt, he takes Palestine, he takes Persia, he spreads right over to India. He is a whirlwind. But at his death, you remember, he had no son to inherit his kingdom, and it was divided four ways, okay, and became the Seleucid, the Seleucids here, and the Ptolemies down here in Egypt. It broke up into four pieces, but the two pieces that interest us are the Seleucids here and the Ptolemies here. Now this parallels, of course, what we've already seen, the great vision that Nebuchadnezzar originally saw in chapter 2. You remember where the gold head was Babylon? Now Babylon is a lion. The silver chest and arms was Media, and now it's a bear. The bronze abdomen and thighs was Persia, and now it's a leopard. The iron legs, and you remember the iron into the feet, but with clay, unstable, okay, Alexander and the Seleucids. Now we'll work our way into that a little more as we move along. So you may have questions, and we will work them out. But now, really, this is what begins to happen in Daniel chapter 7. We have multiple levels of fulfillment. This is very critical with Daniel 7. And so we're going to have a fulfillment, okay, that is going to be in that period of history that Daniel is looking at immediately. He's going to live to see Babylon replaced by Media and Persia. He's going to live to see that. And then he's now looking forward to seeing Greece, but then after Greece, Antiochus Epiphanes arises, and he's the great desolator of Israel. He's looking at this period of time. But of course we go beyond that, and we'll see in Daniel 7 aspects of the first advent of Jesus, and we'll see in Daniel 7 aspects of the second advent of Jesus. And so this material is very, 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 very rich. And what I'm going to do, first of all, is I'm going to give you something that you've kind of got on all your handouts, but they're to be read at home, okay? So this is a little kind of overview to get you into the feel of this, and then you may have some questions. Okay, let's just kind of get our heads around it a little bit. And what I'm really saying here, okay, is if we draw a timeline, okay, and we've had 586, the whole of God's people now have gone into exile, north, south, the temple is destroyed, devastation, collapse, catastrophic, unbelievable, but it's happened, okay? So now we're over, okay, we're over here, and Babylon is reigning. Babylon will fall, okay, then it will be, well, Media is already rising, but then Media Persia, and then it's going to be Greece, Alexander dies, and it's going to be the Seleucids, and it's going to be climaxed in 168 when Antiochus IV, who called himself Epiphanes, which means divine, his enemies called him Epimenes, which means the madman, okay? So they didn't like the Epiphanes, so they changed to Epimenes, the madman, does astonishing things. I'll enumerate them to you. And why he does them, in fact, I don't know if I can find a little... He eliminated the high priesthood, okay? And this was the line of Zadok that had run for 800 years. He eliminates the high priesthood. He dedicated the temple to a Greek god. Can you imagine this? And of course he set up a pagan altar on top of the altar of God. Antiochus Epiphanes, you'll get him, don't worry, again and again, okay? He's going to come round repeatedly. Okay, he's going to stay with us for a couple of weeks, this character. Okay, he commands them to worship this idol. Can you imagine? Here's Israel. First two commandments are against idolatry. He commands them to worship the idol and to eat pork. And if you circumcise your child, both the child and you are executed. And then he bans the Sabbath. I mean, can you imagine anything? You know, I mean, the Jews are going to get angry. I mean, this is unbelievable. The Romans never did anything like this. You know, the Romans put some parameters around Israel, but they actually legitimized Judaism. It was a legal religion. I mean, this was madness, and this gave rise to, you remember, the Maccabeans and Judas Maccabees, and they revolted. But anyways, this is the great crisis that I believe the book of Daniel is looking towards. And it will be the greatest crisis until the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. But this period, you see, that's going to come in here, I believe becomes a paradigm that works its way out in different historical periods. And so that's the basic overlay. Let's just go through it quickly. Number one. The book is framed by the historical events beginning in 586 and concluding in 168. They needed revelation to understand that now they're being violated, the people of God are being violated by these beasts. This lion, which was Babylon, okay? This bear, which was Media. This leopard, which was Persia. And then this indescribable beast, you know, that just tramps and destroys. Okay, Daniel is probably purposely ambiguous about the identity of the beasts. And many, many people, you know, will go to great lengths, okay, to say, well, actually, no, it was Babylon, but then it was Media Persia, and then, you know, it was Greece, and then it was Rome, etc., etc. But I think, you see, he could have named them. He could have named them, but he doesn't. And I think why he doesn't is we're encouraged to look into this window, to look through this keyhole, and reapply the material as we move through history. And we'll find in a minute that Jesus himself does that. Thirdly, the meaning of the beasts is not limited to the concrete realities of Persia, Greece, etc. You see, they embody, and this is the critical thing, they embody supernatural forces that lie behind them. And we know, you see, when Hitler arises in the Third Reich, it's not simply a man, because the German people are the most cultured people, most intelligent people probably in Europe. They've been permeated with the gospel since the Reformation. How can this beast arise? Because behind it are supernatural principalities and powers that are operating. And so what we see through this imagery is not just Babylon, okay, not just Persia, but we're seeing supernatural forces of destruction that lie behind them. Fourthly, and this is where we'll get into the material more deeply, the last beast has 10 horns, and you know usually in scripture a horn stands for strength, often political strength, has 10 horns, okay, and another horn arises out of their midst. Okay, so the last beast is Greece, and out of Greece, okay, it breaks down into different sections. You remember the Seleucids in here, the Ptolemies here, and the other sections to his empire. But this one, okay, probably has 10 Hellenistic rulers. Okay, so up come 10 rulers out of this section of the empire. And Antiochus, okay, is the 11th that arises out of their midst. And we'll come back to that. However, this event becomes a keyhole through which we can understand the activity of the enemy in the future. Now turn to Matthew 24 for a minute, and you'll see this is exactly what Jesus does. And this is what I believe we're supposed to do with this material. So Matthew 24 and verse 15, Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, okay, that will happen in 70 AD. Now Matthew 24 is a great chapter that addresses two questions. Beginning of Matthew 24, notice verse 3, as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us when this will be." Okay, when what will be? Well, back up to verse 2, and they say, "Master, look at these wonderful temple stones." And Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." And they come and say, "Tell us, when will this be?" Question one, when will the temple fall? When will Jerusalem be destroyed? And, second question, what will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age? And basically, without going into a lot of detail, the first half of Matthew 24 is roughly about the fall of Jerusalem, but the second half of Matthew 24 is about the end of the age. And you remember, as we've been looking at prophecy, this is how it works. You see, if I'm to be established, if I'm to validate my prophetic credentials, and I say to Amanda, I'm going to tell you about an event 500 years ago. Well, how can she know whether I'm speaking with authority? We're both going to be dead in 500 years. But I'm going to tell you now something that's going to happen in 5 years' time. Do you see what I mean? When that comes to pass, she knows, indeed, I am a prophet with authority. So Jesus gives them detail about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD to validate his authority to speak prophetically about the end of the age. Are you with me? And one becomes a keyhole again for the other. Now, so verse 15, we're still on the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, verse 15, and he says, "So when you see the desolating sacrilege," it might have in your translation "the abomination of desolations," "spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place," brackets, "let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down." Okay, why want you to go down if you're on the housetop? You remember? Old Jerusalem. Why want you to go down? Remember? Fastest way out of Jerusalem was across the rooftops. Just little alleyways between everything. If you wanted to get out of Jerusalem, don't come down. You go across the roof. Don't get jammed in the little narrow thoroughfares. You get out of the city across the rooftops. That's why you don't come down. "And let him," verse 18, "and let him who is in the field not turn back to take his mantle. And alas for those who are with child, who give suck in those days," etc., etc. And so when the Christians saw the Romans beginning to lay siege to Jerusalem, they left. They left on the basis of these words in 70 AD. And in fact, that was one of the reasons for the growing rift between early Christian Jews and non-Christian Jews, because they felt they had abandoned the city, but they abandoned it on the basis of this verse. Now, what Jesus says is, he says, when the Romans come in, you see, and they're going to stand in the temple with their standards on which was the image of the emperor, you see, and they were to go, what they didn't do in the lifetime of Jesus, go right into the temple courts, okay, and eventually they're going to level the whole thing. You see, that's exactly what Antiochus did in 168, you see. And he becomes a keyhole, you see, for now seeing what the enemy always seeks to do, do you see what I mean, which is to pillage and pollute the people of God, okay, be it the Jewish people of God, or be it the Christian people of God. And so Jesus reaches back and he says, you've got to understand, this is what was happening in the day of Daniel. Now, what will happen now is that we're going to get a keyhole that's going to take us beyond Jerusalem right to the end of the age. But we'll get there in a minute. So, on down a little bit further. In a similar way, the book of Revelation uses the historical events described in Daniel as a template for the activities of Antichrist, the beast, in Revelation. And they're linked, okay, by the metaphor of the beast. You remember in Revelation, the Antichrist is a beast, and this empire is a beast in Daniel. And they're linked by this 3.5-year period, which we'll come to. Satan's a dragon, by the way, in Revelation, not a beast. But the Antichrist is a beast. Couple more things. And you've got all this on your papers. Okay, during the reign of these bestial kingdoms, God will intervene and set up his kingdom. And it will be set up immediately after the little horn is put down. Now go, come to verse 9. Back to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 9. Now this is why people get so excited about Daniel chapter 7. And this is why this is a favorite chapter of the Prophecy Club and whatever. Because you see, Jesus sets up, okay, or the kingdom of God is set up immediately after this little horn falls. And so the logic is, if you can identify who the little horn is, do you see what I mean? We know when the Lord is going to be, you know, back within 7 years, once he's really revealed his colors. However, I don't actually go down that road too far, and I'll explain why. Back up to verse 8. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, which three of the first were plucked up by the roots, because Antiochus, you see, was the youngest son, and he usurped the place of his three older brothers to get to the throne. So he plucks them up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man. So initially he looks human, but actually is a beast, and a mouth speaking great things. And verse 9, and as I looked, okay, so here's this little horn arising who actually becomes a great beast. And as I looked, thrones were placed, and one that was the Ancient of Days took his seat, and the kingdom comes in. And we'll see that repeated three times in Daniel. And so that's why, you know, this becomes such a litmus kind of test of where we are in the kind of prophetic clock. But we'll come back to that. However, this doesn't mean that the Fourth Empire still exists as a concrete political entity, but that the principalities and powers that were behind it will have another concrete embodiment in the future. Are you with me? Now, this is why some people are so hot on Rome being the last empire, because they say that Rome has perpetuated itself, okay, into the Holy Roman Empire, and now into the European Economic Treaty of Rome, etc., etc. So we can expect the Antichrist to arise out of the kind of vestigial Roman Empire, which actually I don't think you can substantiate historically at all. And I give you the details in your paper, and you can read them and ask questions next week. Then finally, and this is for me, this is very, very important. You remember in chapter 2, okay, here's the vision in chapter 2. The gold head, the silver chest, the bronze abdomen, the iron legs. And you remember there's a stone cut out, not by human hands, speaking of Christ, who is the rock. And can you remember which part of the image the stone strikes? The feet, okay? And so it strikes the feet, and then the whole image collapses and is crushed. Now you see, if it's literal, when the stone struck the feet, the head had disappeared, and so had the chest, and so had the abdomen, because these empires had disappeared. Are you with me? But if we're talking also about the spiritual powers, okay, that stand behind bestial empires, whether it's the Stalins, the Hitlers, the Pol Pots, or the Milosevic's, do you see what I mean? They just transfer themselves. You know, they don't go away. Do you see what I mean? They just attach themselves onto another Antiochus figure, and they aren't hard to find, unfortunately. Now the same in chapter 7, if you look in verse 11, I say the fourth empire is destroyed before the first three in chapter 7, and this implies that we should also view them as supernatural entities. And so in verse 11, it says, I looked then because of the sound of the great words which this little horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was slain. That's the fourth beast out of which he had arisen. And its body was destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. You get the point. So now here we see the last empire, okay, the last empire being destroyed, but the previous three being allowed to continue for some time. Now, if these are just linear empires in time, that's impossible. You see the point. But if we're also looking, and this is what happens with apocalyptic literature, this is what happens in the book of Revelation, if we're also seeing behind the natural the stance of the supernatural, then it makes complete sense. And these can have embodiments in the future. That's why I don't think it's particularly important who the fourth empire even was politically. What it's saying is that this beast Antiochus devastates the people of God, and that is the strategy of the enemy in 70 AD, that is the strategy of the enemy at the end of the age, and that is the strategy of the enemy in the generation in which I live. And we can hold him back, hopefully, by intercession. One of the difficulties presented by the apocalyptic nature of Daniel chapter 7, and you remember now this material is all apocalyptic. We've only really got Daniel, Zechariah, bits of Ezekiel and Revelation that are this genre of apocalyptic. And you remember that the Jews do not regard Daniel as prophecy because the genre is different. Okay, it's apocalyptic. And he is not particularly speaking about Israel. He's speaking about the nations, which puts him in a different category. But because it's apocalyptic, okay, I've said already, are the beasts natural or supernatural? See, that's an important question to ask because of the nature of the material. And I've mentioned about that the fourth falls before the first three. Are these events taking place on earth, in heaven, or both? Okay, here's this little horn that plucks up three horns. It has eyes like a man, speaks great things. Verse 9, and as I look, thrones were placed, and one that was the Ancient of Days took his seat. On earth or in heaven? Okay, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. Okay, is this physical warfare, spiritual warfare, or both? You get the point. Same issue in Revelation. And it's the nature of apocalyptic that we're unsure whether we're looking at, what's happening in the heavens, spiritual warfare, or what's happening on the earth. Are the numbers literal or symbolic? Okay, we've got 10 horns, and we know 10 is the number of plenitude in Hebrew. Then we've got 4 winds, 4 wings, 4 beasts, etc. And 4, of course, north, south, east, west, is speaking of global reach. 70, we're going to have 70 weeks, and remember, don't get confused by a week. It's just like we use a decade. They used a week, 7 years, okay? So 7 weeks, 70 times 7, 490 years. But 490 years is 10 jubilees. Are you with me? So what we're moving towards is the jubilee of the jubilee. You get the point. It's wonderful symbolism, this 70 weeks, 490 years. Hey, we're already in the Jubilee, but this will be the plenitude of the Jubilee, the kingdom of God. Are we viewing events surrounding the first advent, the second, or both? Now let me give you an illustration. Come to verse 13 and then to Matthew 26. You're in Matthew 25. Let's go to 13 and then to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, 63. And Daniel 7 and verse 13. Okay, so Daniel 7:13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven. Now the clouds of heaven were sometimes described as the incense clouds. You remember the high priest could not go into the Holy of Holy unless he was clothed with clouds. Okay, it's wonderful incense, prayers of the saints, the clouds of heaven. And so he comes with the clouds of heaven, and there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days. Okay, so is it Jesus having died, having been buried, having been raised, having ascended as now our great high priest, coming with the clouds, just like the high priest did, of incense into the presence of the Ancient of Days? Or is it Jesus coming with the clouds to the Ancient of Days at the end of the age? You get the point. And to him was given, verse 14, glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. Well, we know at the end of Matthew, all authority is given to him in heaven and on earth. And we go out with the gospel so that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. So is it the ascension, or is it the second coming, or is it both? Okay, so now go to Matthew and you'll see the same kind of thing. Matthew 26, verse 63. Jesus was silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you, he puts him under oath, by the living God, tell us if you are the anointed one. Okay, that's the word Christ, okay, Messiah, anointed one, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so, but I tell you, hereafter you will see. Okay, not literally, but metaphorically. The high priest is going to see something. In his lifetime, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with or on the clouds of heaven. Now, what does the high priest do at that point? You see, he shreds his robes, okay? He's so infuriated because Jesus is using a high priestly metaphor about himself. Hey, if Jesus is the high priest, Caiaphas isn't. You see the point? They can't both be at this point. And that's why he is so enraged, because he's the high priest. But Jesus is using high priestly language from the book of Daniel. You get the point? So is this, now again, is this, he's saying to him, you're going to see this. Now obviously he wouldn't see it he wouldn't see it literally, but through the rise of the church and the destruction of the temple, it was like the end of the era, legitimizing a new high priesthood in Jesus. Do you see what I mean? He'd see it in that sense. You'll see the Son of Man seated, even as Stephen did, at the right hand of power, and coming on or with the clouds of heaven. So is it the Lord ascending, okay, with the incense of the cross and his atonement to the Ancient of Days, or is it Jesus coming with the clouds at the end of the age? You see the point? You can read it both ways. And perhaps we're supposed to read it both ways. You get the point. Anyways, and then, what did I say? And then lastly, and this is an important one, and I've given you some information on your sheets. Do phrases like the time of the end, okay, and this comes many times in Daniel in slightly different words, only refer to the end of the age, or do they sometimes refer to the end of the immediate historical period under review, the events under Antiochus Epiphanes? And so the question is, when Daniel speaks of the time of the end, is he speaking of this, okay, when finally, through the Maccabeans, this is put down, or is he speaking of the end of time? Well, the answer is, again, both. Okay, the answer is both, sometimes here, and sometimes the end of the age. And so that's the difficulty, and so we have to approach this material with some humility. You see, we can't necessarily, you know, dot every I and cross every T. I don't think that's possible to do with this kind of material. But we can find extraordinarily powerful teaching to help us in what we should be doing in our day. Back to Daniel 7, and a couple of things before we close. Now, what I'm going to do, for the sake of time, okay, is when we look at Daniel 7, when we look at issues of the Antichrist, and we have many different scholars coming along with many different opinions, depending on whether they believe in what we call historic premillennialism, or postmillennialism, or amillennialism, or dispensational premillennialism, etc. Now, we don't have time to go into all those, okay, and you can do some more reading if you want to. But what I want to say is I'm going to work it through on the first, historic premillennialism, as I think it's pretty clear that that's what the early church saw, a simple scheme without a secret rapture. Now, I've taught some of you before that a secret rapture was only taught beginning with Nelson Darby, who was Irish. He was an Anglican clergyman in the beginning, and he started the Plymouth Brethren, and he was the first to teach a secret rapture. Now, it's become very ubiquitous today, and it's, you would think that everybody believes in the secret rapture, but they don't, okay? It's particularly North American dispensationalism that brought it in so strongly. And so, however, if you believe in a secret rapture, you don't have to abandon it for my sake, okay? And we'll all know when it happens, okay, who was right. We'll all know, okay? You know, it won't be the Lord saying, you know, all those believing in a secret rapture, up you come now, you know. Laura, sorry, you don't. You deserve wait on now. Won't be like that, okay? The Lord will do what the Lord will do. But we have to, you know, follow it through with some sort of paradigm, with some sort of grid. And I can't follow it through. You know, some people believe the Antichrist isn't a person. He stands for an evil principle, etc., etc. I'm going to go with a simple scheme, okay, of historic premillennialism, where there is this important seven-year period before the coming of the Lord, but knowing, okay, that I may not be right, but trying to give you a scholarly view that has been taught throughout the history of the church. That's the value of, not that these others have not come in, okay, and not that I don't greatly respect the others, but we don't have time to work it through on all four. And so I need to give you kind of at least, you know, a run through. And the advantage of grasping one scheme, do you see what I mean, is then it gives you a template to understand others, and so it's not without value. Do you see what I mean? So let me say one thing, I think, in closing. Now, what we're going to look at, Daniel, you'll remember, when we get to chapter 9, and we'll come to this, Daniel is going to speak of these 70 weeks. We would say 70 decades. Okay, he says so. The Jews worked in sevens, so we've got 70 weeks. Sounds very mysterious. It's not at all. Okay, so 70 weeks is how long? 490 years, of course. And what we're going to find is, and we'll work this out, is that if we work, and this is not without dispute, but we're going to use, and it was worked out by Julius Africanus, an early church father, so we're on good solid ground, even though not everybody would agree with this scheme. But we're going to work, when the decree went out in 444 to rebuild Jerusalem, this is Nehemiah, you can track, okay, 483 years to the crucifixion. Okay, you can do that, and I'll do that with you when we come to when we come to Daniel chapter 9, which is extraordinary, right to the very year of the crucifixion. We have to do some adjustments for the different calendars, etc., but we'll do that when we get to. But this is okay. But 70 weeks was how long? 490. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so we're going to have 69 weeks spoken of, okay, which means that there's 1 week left hanging, a 7 year week left hanging, and this is what's picked up in the book of Revelation. And that's why this period of 7 years and 3.5 years, you come to, sometimes it's calibrated in days, and this is this period before, okay, before the Lord comes, of 7 years. And in the dispensational premillennial scheme, they believe that the church is raptured at the beginning of that 7 year period. Okay? So that's what we're going to work through. And so in conclusion for the morning, let's just look at this quickly, and then you can read the chapters in more detail, read the papers, and we can interact a little bit more next. Okay, this 7 year, now, the interesting thing is, okay, we've got 7 years hanging, okay, we got out here in the future, picked up in the book of Revelation. Now, the interesting thing is the issues with Antiochus, okay, you remember the empire drawings, okay, of Babylon, okay, of Media, of Persia, of Greece into the Seleucids, taking us into the period with Antiochus. The situation with Antiochus lasted for 7 years. And in the middle of the 7 year period, after 3.5 years, there was a big switch. Because at the beginning, kind of apostate Jews, they approached Antiochus and said, can we make a covenant with you? Because if they did that, Jerusalem would become a polis, a Greek city, they would pay less taxes, they would have economic, Antiochus started like a university, they called it a gymnasium in the Greek language, but it was like a university in Jerusalem, and they could engage in international trade. And so for the first period, the first about 3.5 years, you know, they should never have done it, and the pious Jews didn't want it done, but what they called reformist Jews did. Actually apostate Jews. But then after the 3.5 years, you know, Antiochus, for some strange reason, starts banning the Sabbath, making them eat pork, refusing to circumcise them, etc. And so here you've got this 7 year period, okay, with Antiochus, broken down 7 years in the middle. Okay? And that again becomes a paradigm that's picked up in the book of Revelation. Because we've only got, okay, we've only got 69 years to the cross. This is Matt's point. We've got all this specificity right up to the cross, and then, hey, we're on our own, seemingly. Well, you can't really, you know, you take a long time to map out the whole history of the church. And so what seems to happen is this 1 7-year period that's left hanging, that was modeled by Antiochus, okay, is picked up as a paradigm right at the end of the age in the book of Revelation. So let's just say a couple of things in closing. He makes a covenant with apostate reformist Jews somewhere between 175 and 170. I don't think I've given you the sheet, have I? No, that's okay. You don't need it. You got the information on you. Okay, so somewhere between 175 and 170, he makes a covenant for economic advantage that they can trade internationally, they can pay less taxes, they can become a Greek polis, they can have the equivalent to a university. 3.5 years later, he goes wild and he sets up an idol in the temple, refuses circumcision, the Sabbath, etc., etc., etc. Now, these events are seen by some scholars as foreshadowing the 7-year period before the return of Christ. And so, the 7-year period, now we're to the end of the age, okay? 7-year period begins with the rise to power of an anti-Messiah type figure, just like Antiochus was. He was against the Lord's anointed. You see, that's why anti-Messiah, against the Lord's anointed, that's all it means. His rise to power, Paul calls him the man of sin, you remember, in 2 Thessalonians. There's then a period of great tribulation, Revelation 7, as there was in this period under Antiochus. It's the last week of the 70 years described by Daniel. We'll get to that in chapter 9. It's broken down into 2 3.5-year periods, just as under Antiochus, the first 3.5 years seemed to go well, the second 3.5 were an absolute disaster, okay? And the Antichrist will make a covenant with apostate believers before showing his true colors 3.5 years later. Are you with me? Just like up here, okay, he makes a covenant, but then he shows his true colors 3.5 years later. Now, of course, if you believe, and don't think I'm putting it down too heavily, because I'm not, if you believe in dispensational premillennialism, and the church is taken out of the way 7 years before, who does he make a covenant with? With the Jews. Yeah. And so that's been very, and that's why in Darby's system, he would say, that God only works either with the Jews or with the church. Okay, when the Jews rejected Jesus, God stopped working with them altogether. Okay. After the church is taken out of the way, he'll start working with the Jews again. Now, I don't believe that that's true, because God is not willing that any should perish. Okay, and so that's why I don't believe that. I believe that the covenant under Antiochus is a paradigm. But a very similar thing will happen. The Jews may be included here if they're saved at that time, okay? If all Israel has come to the Lord. But I believe it's just a paradigm that there will be some sort of alliance, not with the true church, okay? Not with the true church. But just as Antiochus made it with kind of apostate Jews, there will be some sort of covenant made, and we'll see that in Daniel 7, okay, before 3.5 years later, he shows his true colors.